Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland. I have Terrence Hayes here with me in the studio, and Terrence has been on this show before. He's running for city council, and we've received a fair amount of good, I would call it good press from your episode. And your episode is one of the most downloaded episodes that I've done on this podcast. So when you came here offline, I was saying, thank you so much. And I really mean it. I mean, it helps me. And more people have been brought into this show because of your episode than I think in recent memory. I mean, the last person I can think of is maybe Renee Gonzalez, but I really appreciate it, Terrence. Thank you.
No problem. I appreciate you having me. And listen, ain't nobody been more controversial than Renee. And the fact that I'm even comparing, I appreciate that. Shout out to Renee Gonzalez, the mayor that I support for our city. So I'll double down on that.
Do you want to be controversial?
I think controversy happened for me because I refuse to be bubbled into a narrative, right? I think only reason I'm controversial is because as a black man who's coming into this race is rational, and bringing a voice of black people back to it is controversial for people who've survived and built empires on the back of black trauma, right? Especially in this city. I should make progressive folks nervous because they've told my story as a method to push their narratives. And so me coming now and saying that's actually not how black people feel, and I'm actually from this community, I do the work in this community, yeah, some folks are going to get nervous by that.
What do you think makes them nervous?
Truth always makes people nervous. I think so. Think about this. I'm formerly incarcerated. I did 13 years in prison.
Right.
From 20 to 33, I was in prison. I come from a gang background. There probably ain't a crime in like urban criminal thinking that I haven't committed. Right. And those have been the narratives. People like me have been the narratives of folks that has built progressive policy and progressive thoughts and progressive bullying on the back of my story. So now I'm coming and I'm going, hey, all that is cool, but it didn't work, right? Like, you defunded, that didn't help the black community. We never screamed out for defunding. We said that there were clear problems that existed between the black community and police, and we want to address that. We want to have real conversations. They didn't give us a voice, and now I'm calling that out. I'm saying you never asked the black community how we felt about defunding. You never asked us about how we felt about the marches and the protests. Did black Portlanders participate at high numbers? Those are real questions that people need to ask. Where was black Portland during the marches? Is that what we asked for? And it was done in our name. So I'm the person that's coming out and saying, we never asked for any of those things. What we really asked for was a voice. And then for me to now come into this and challenge the way they've used our narrative, and to be able to gain a voice that's not controlled by them, makes me problematic, right? Because they can't tell me what to say, who to say it for, and they can't dismiss me, because even before I decided to get into this space, I served in a community. I worked in restorative justice. I've done the work. I'm daily a part of young men that's at risk in the community, finding work, finding homes, right? Getting them on a path that they can self-rely. I'm not asking. A mentor of mine always say, you know, we got to leave this narrative of white benevolence, right? Black people are strong. They're intelligent. They're present. We have the ability to stand on our own, to build community up. We don't have to always be in a light up underneath our white counterparts. We should be lined up in this journey together, right? We should be literally walking these paths hand to hand instead of middle-aged white progressive women, and I'll double down on that, right? Always determining that they can lead, right? We've seen it in our movies. Movie after movie, movie growing up, it was this white woman that came into the ghetto, and somehow she had what it takes to save the Bullock, over and over again. When does it end? Right? And what I'm challenging is this narrative that we need
women,
that.
Isn't it? I don't know without it.
Well, I mean, listen, I can get on that tangent about, don't set me up for that. But what I'll say is that it has been black elders. It has been my strong, beautiful black wife who has challenged me to be the best version of myself. I built healthy relationship with white men and women, but I didn't build that from a position of need. I built it from a position of camaraderie and walking this down together. And if you've been able to, quote unquote, lead black people out of white people's oppression, I am problematic for you and I should make you nervous. And I'm okay with that because it's actually not about that narrative, right? If black folks are going to be able to play on even field, we have to have access. I always say the biggest thing is it's not particularly individual white people. That's nonsense. The thing is we need to deal with any systems that keep black folks from having access. We need to deal with any systems that keep black folks. If those systems aren't there, we need to stop screaming that they are. Right. And we
what
need
systems are those.
Any of them. So, for instance, if you look inside a government, right, and I'll give you an example for myself. When I applied for the job at the city of Portland as a ceasefire community advocate, right, that job was very detailed that somebody out of the community who had history and restorative justice, who had the ability to do this work, who had community connections and relationships. I think that job paid anywhere from 80 to like 95,000, 100,000, somewhere in that gap. And for me, when you read the job description, like, I've done the work. Who else can do this job at that level? And if I'm highly qualified, then why was my offer low? Why didn't I get the top end? So when you look at the matrix that they use to determine the value of that job, nowhere in that matrix was community involvement. Can I prove relationships with community? Community recommendations. So you had a very specific job for people out of the community, but you didn't have a matrix to determine equity based on those relationships. So you can't convince me that if I was a middle-aged white woman with a degree in socioeconomics or some, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, they would have offered me on a higher scale. How do you gauge the value of community servants without a box to check for those community members? That's what equity has to look like for me. It is not determining I'm simply going to let black folks in because they black. It's having matrix to value what black folks bring to the table and not use prototypical matrix. We say, well, a lot of black people haven't went to college. Well, let not college be the only box that can get me to the higher wage. Where's the balance to that? We're talking about gun violence reduction. We're talking about somebody with lived experience. Your degree is not going to impact our culture in gun violence reduction.
Is that, I'm trying to understand, is that what they said they were looking for in the job description, a college degree?
No, but I'm saying not in a job description, but when they determine your pay scale.
I got it.
Those are the boxes they check. It is not community involvement,
yeah, no, I see
right?
what you're saying.
So they had this fancy language that seems very equitable on the surface to get the job, but the economics didn't line up, right? So I've
certainly not in Portland, right? We just don't have a very big black community. You got to consider the demographics of the black community. If you want black people in those jobs, what are the demographics of the community?
I totally agree. But when we get the jobs, what does it matter if I get
you the job?
No, I'm with you. But if I get you the job and you're there, if I can't pay you comparatively, that's a systematic problem.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
I didn't look at the person that made that decision and say, oh, you're racist, right? I said that the boxes create problems that impact black and brown, Native American. I always give this example. If you create a job description for alcoholism in a Native American community, you want an elder out of that community with lived experience, right?
Yeah.
But when it's time to pay that individual, that lived experience or that eldership is not a way to determine value. or pay scale.
Right.
So only everything.
They're looking at college degrees. They're looking at, yeah.
That has nothing to do with that individual, culturally specifically, right? Or what they bring to the table for that job. So we create equitable jobs, quote unquote, but they never pay out. They never walk down economic equality, right? We get the job, but I'm not paid as well. And one of the challenges I had that never got answered by the city is why do you create jobs that is supposed to reflect equitability, but you don't find ways to pay people on that with that same matrix? So that's what I mean when I'm talking about system, not people, right? And certainly people go, well, are you dismissing that there's racist people? This is what happened. People reach and they go out of context all the time. No, I'm talking about jobs and equitability. At the end of the day, equality without economics is a lie. It's a distraction. And it's not fair to the black folks that's done the work to be in the positions that they are in.
Yeah, and the reason I say look at the demographics of the community is in Chicago, it might be a lot different.
Right.
You know, you right. might have a bigger black population right. that has a fair amount of college education. Right. In Portland, we don't have a large black population. Right. So figure out what the demographics are.
Right.
If those are the people you want in these jobs, and then do your boxes accordingly is what you're saying.
It's exactly what I'm saying. You said it perfectly.
Right. I never thought about that because when you started talking, I just thought, gosh, all I hear from the city is that they want black people in these jobs. Yeah. And so it just seemed like, of course they'd be looking for that, but you're right. I mean, if they set the criteria up in a way that forecloses the exact population they're looking for from getting it, it doesn't make any sense.
And you wonder why we don't stay in city jobs. They still cannot keep black folks, right? Because once we start, once we start looking at the number, you can't get them and you can't keep them, right? Because listen, once we get there and you start looking at the numbers, we realize that the pay scale still ain't adding up. Right. Because you gotta, folks do this thing where they expose all these historical systematic issues. Right. How we determine somebody's pay scale. We know that a lot of that is more advantageous to our white counterparts than it is to blacks. But they will not add things inside of that to balance that. Right. So if we know that young black man, for instance, don't go to college as much, but we want to see young black men in these fields, we have to create pathways to reflect, right, what we know to be true in the statistics. But we don't want to do that, right? We want to talk about being equitable. We want to talk about all those things, but black folks are still not owning as many homes. Our entrepreneurship is struggling without real support, right? And so we got 4 years of ultra-progressive policies in this city, and black folks are not better off because of it.
How are we going to fix that?
I think we have to let black people, I'm talking about specifically the black folks, right? We got to let black people speak for black people. We have to stop assuming that we have the answers for cultures of people without speaking to those people. Now, it's not a one size fit all for sure, but culturally you're gonna find some similar concerns because that's how culture works, right? So we need people that's actually, if we're gonna talk about investing into the black community, right? We have to have honest dialogue about where the least investment is happening, and if we invest there, do we get the best results? Right. Anytime anybody else or any other plan is invested in, we have measurements of success. Right. I do not think that the black community any service by not having high levels of expectations from investments. Black people have the ability to be excellent. We have a lot of excellent businessmen, doctors, lawyers, politicians, religious leaders. Why do the city get to decide that black people there shouldn't be an excellent standard for them also? I just disagree with any notion. You look at what the school board did.
Terrence. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? This is Portland Public Schools.
Yeah, Portland Public Schools decided that it is so equitable that it's going to determine to lower the standard of graduation because black kids couldn't keep up. This is the mind state of this city. Instead of asking ourselves, what is the teaching, is there some cultural differences in teaching or information that we can help black kids get to the standards, right, that we have, which I don't think is that very high in the first place, right? But we have to figure out, we're always screaming, what is the root cause in this city? And then when it comes to black people, we're going, well, we're not going to address the root cause in the education gap. We're simply going to lower the standards. This is the hypocrisy. At the end of the day, to try to say that black kids don't have the ability to learn at the same rate.
No, it's one of the most racist things I've ever heard.
Ever seen. And then when you accent folks on the school board, they're, oh, it's above my pay grade. Oh, that, you know, who made the decision? If nobody's going to cop to it, where is your progressive activist when we make decision that lower standards for black kids and have the gumption to publicly say we only lowered the standard because black kids couldn't show up? Where's the activists? Where are they when they're putting black kids at disadvantage? And I would say where you have the public audacity to tell black kids you ain't smart enough. Right? So they pick and they choose. And this is why I'm calling out that progressive behavior, that extreme progressive behavior, because you keep saying you care about black communities, yet you've actually been part of destroying the standards that allow black people to compete at the highest levels. And then when it's over, when these kids in this school leave, they are not going to have success like they should because we determined that they wasn't smart enough. I reject that. I got a son, 16-year-old, right? We literally, he's a self-manager for the record. His name's Sincere. We literally just trust him. This boy got a 3.75, right? Now, according to their standard, my son can't keep up at that level. But nobody is saying, well, when a father is in a home, when a mother is in a home, when economics is in a home, where he's allowed to play sports without fear or burden, right? He can be a great student athlete. Nobody's coming to successful black families with children that's excelling in school and asking us our opinion. They're making it for us. And it's getting old. And I have a lot of amazing black families with mothers and fathers in a home that are challenging this narrative that their children aren't smart enough to keep up with their white, Asian, and Hispanic counterparts. It's a lie.
People just aren't listening to them, or what is going on there?
It's a narrative shift. If I start listening, listen, if we were able to raise millions of dollars on this narrative that black folks ain't enough and they can't do it themselves, there's some big salaries happening in these non-for-profits. If I'm right and other black families are right, those should have been, listen, imagine if we invested $50 million in grants for black-owned companies, right? We're not just throwing money at them. We're giving them the knowledge and support. We're giving them mentorship. One of the best things, and I'll give the city of Portland this, one of the best things that happened for my company was that before they handed me a contract, they linked me up with a bigger company, white-owned company, and he committed to help mentor me in graffiti removal. Right. And so that mentorship allowed me to not make a bunch of mistakes. It allowed me to have support. Right. And then that relationship ultimately led to more business and opportunity. But if I told you that it was good, if white, black, or indifferent, if a white man is very good in a space and he's having high levels of success, it is not unreasonable to say, hey, will you help this young black company go? Right. Let's have honest dialogue, build honest relationships, and get out of the way. Most companies, most people need internships, entrepreneurships, right? Even if you're going to give and support black businesses, wrap them around other successful business people. And especially if they're black business owners, because they can understand some of the cultural struggles and knowledge gaps that exist.
But a lot of it, too, is it goes back to the academics, does it not? Because when you were talking about success and achievement, I mean, Terrence, you're a smart guy.
Thank
you're
you.
Gonna be you know this, but you're gonna be successful at whatever you mm-hmm. do. So a lot of it is hooking the right people up
yes.
with the right people
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just acknowledging competence and success.
Thank you.
And acknowledging some kind of potential there, yeah. I think.
It is. I mean, relationships matter, right? I was able to come in with Paul Watts, which I just got to love. We're in competition now, but I still love him. Big brother to me. But he's a white man, white bald head man, right? And when we first sat at the table, when we first sat at the table, I'm like, here we go. They're trying to put me in a room with this white dude, and he's supposed to save me. And we just spent time together. Even before he also decided to mentor me in this space, me and him went out. We had dinner. We talked. We laughed. We actually found out we had more in common than not.
You and I are looking at each other, and I'm going to move your mic so it's like to the side here.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, I can hear you great, but I just want to hear you better.
Right.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
No, but what I'm saying is, we had to have an honest dialogue, and that dialogue led to truth, and that's when we decided to work together. And during that time was when the mayor did the emergency declaration, and we were doing graffiti removal downtown. He allowed us to use his trucks, his equipment, his material, and it was just through honest relationship building. And it worked out really well and allowed my company to become a little more sustainable. The point I'm trying to make is that we just need the same basic business opportunities and access that everybody else get. If you do not allow us to learn in a way that everybody else get to learn, we end up at a disadvantage. The black man who mentored me in business believes in black excellence, consistency, the same thing that a white businessman would expect when he or she mentors somebody. So at the end of the day, the principles have to be accessible to everybody. Right. And if you don't give everybody access to the principles, it becomes problematic. And I think we have two extremes. Right. We have this systematic extreme that if we're not careful, I don't get access to the principles. And we got the other side that believes it's their job to save me. So they know the principles. They apply the principles and they just let me ride their coattail to success. I reject both notions. Right. Bring the same access to black folks that you would bring to a law student. Right. Bring the same teachings, the same discipline, the same expectation, and they will do well. But what I'm saying is contrary to what people have made a good living off of so far.
You're talking about like
sort
of nonprofit industrial.
I'm talking about all of them. I'm talking about anybody that think it's their job to save black people.
Robin DiAngelo?
Any of them. This is just where I'm at. If you're not having real dialogue with the community, if you think that you get to speak for the whole of black people, any of us believe that it's nonsense, right? Anybody that think it's your job to come into a community you really don't understand and save those people, the messianic complexes that exist in some of these spaces is astounding to me.
I'm not asking you to name names. Can you talk to me about what you've witnessed?
Yeah. I mean, even now, one of the things I've never imagined that I'll be called a fascist, a bootlicker.
People are calling you that.
Oh, people are calling me everything. And it's interesting because.
Is it white people?
Oh, it's definitely white people. There's two major set of white peoples that have become problematic for me, like the extremely progressive gay white man and middle-aged white woman. It's just true.
I would not have known that.
Yeah, but you have to.
I would have.
But you have to understand why. It's because if what I'm saying feels contrary to what has also been a part of esteeming a community and making sure that they're fighting for folks, I seem problematic. Now, this is not holistic. It's not every middle-aged white woman, and it's not every gay white man, right? I'm talking about very specific people. It takes a certain audacity of a white man or a white woman to call me a race traitor. I don't hear this is what's interesting. I don't hear this from black people. It is not black folks that's coming to me and saying I'm misrepresenting our community. It's always white people.
Yeah, Mingus Mapps was called a race traitor at a city council meeting by a white woman.
How courageous of her to say such a thing about this man knowing
clapped.
Nothing about
him. I mean, It was astounding.
Of course they did, because if he not walking around here talking about he came from a gang life and a hood life, then somehow his blackness ain't legitimate.
But even if he did, I mean, you look, you're doing that.
Exactly.
And your blackness is not legitimate. But in my opinion, it's because it, and I'd love to know what you think about this, but my armchair psychology is because it does not line up with their ideology. And yes, if you're not parroting what they're saying,
yeah,
then I'm they the don't want to hear it.
Of course they don't. Well, I mean, listen.
Then your race doesn't matter anymore.
It's about the ideology.
Yeah, but it's not actually about your race.
It never has been. You leverage. That's all I've always said. The trauma of my community has been leveraged to push ideology. It's never been about that trauma. And this is why, as soon as COVID was over, the marches seemed to diminish off when it comes to Black lives. Where's all the people that ran through the street every day? Have something so changed where Black folks are not at risk anymore that those individuals feel really good about sitting at home now? Where did they go? Where are they at? Is Black people better off in any of these categories than they were 2 or 3 years ago? The data says no. So then I ask, what were you marching for then?
What's the answer?
They self.
Because they need a purpose in their lives. That's their religion, right? That's their meaning in their life.
COVID, when George Floyd was murdered, every moderate progressive had to watch it from home. They couldn't busy themselves. They didn't have the coffee shops to go to and the bakeries to talk about social issues. They had to watch over and over again as he was murdered, right? And all of a sudden, that became their cause because they couldn't avoid it. Black folks have been saying and talking about police brutality for the last 100 years. All of a sudden, this one time is different. I think the time was different because they were forced to watch it. And there was no excuse this time. The videos prove that he literally seemed to take joy by putting his knee on the neck of a man and watching him die. When you have to watch that, it changes things. But again, it's been happening in our community. We're not screaming wolf. Right? It's just what it is. Now, people had to watch it, so they felt obligated to get involved. I just, you know, where are those people now? We just watched that sister. They walked in her house and shot her dad, right? There was no water in a pot. There was no threat, right? Why aren't they marching in the same way about that they did about George Floyd? Was that murder any different? She called the police. She asked for help. What was the difference? It's because they're not sitting at home bored no more. The world has opened up again. Now we can be an activist from the internet and from coffee shops.
Right. Facebook warrior.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So that's my experience. My experience is it's not my community that have a problem with me saying we need more officers. In fact, every time I'm talking to my community, they agree that we need an increased officer presence to deter violence. The data says those presence deter violence. We don't have to go back to pulling people over nonsense. We don't have to go back to getting you for jaywalking. We learned a lot of good lessons over the last couple years. But the fact is, we have a gun violence problem. And as a person who once committed gun violence in the community, I know the police presence deter gun violence. Yes, we need resources. We need to address root causes. No one's arguing those things. But if you're trying to tell me we don't need to increase police presence as part of that solution base, we disagree. And I would argue that the data disagrees with you. We defunded. We didn't restructure. And a whole bunch of Black people had to die. Young Black men had to die before we end up bringing a different version of that team back anyway.
Yeah, the headlines were Portland was one of the most dangerous places in America for Black men.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I believe it now.
Because of the police.
Yeah, I believe it. Because unlike all the internet trolls, I actually show up to the scenes. I'm there with the moms. I'm there with the siblings. I'm there with the family
members.
Because
you're on the FitCog team.
Because I'm the chair of the FitCog and I worked with Ceasefire, right? I helped build that out. And so part of Ceasefire thing is we show up on those murder scenes and give aid to grieving families. Our community-based organizations do every day. So it's interesting that it is not people that serve in a community that have the biggest voice on right and wrong when it comes to police interaction. It's people that have never had these experiences in the first place. They have the bigger voice. So until you show up on a murder scene at 4 a.m. and you have to look a mother in her eyes as she constantly saying, that's not my son, that's not my son. And you have to try to get officers to speed up a process so that that mother can verify that that's her son. We all know it, but until she sees that, she won't believe it because that's her son. Until you know it, that look and feel like you can't tell me anything about public safety, especially when it comes to gun violence in the black and brown communities. I show up on those scenes. I deal with those families. I help get resources to the table when they lose essential family members. It is not all group or gang violence. These are innocent people dying also. Children, women.
Stray bullets.
Stray bullets. Non-affiliates are dying. College kids are dying.
Yeah.
Every day. So you can't tell me that I don't understand what the community needs.
Well, you were a college kid when somebody tried to kill you.
You dang right I was. Ain't that interesting? But people like the narrative of the felon, they don't really want to talk about that I went to Western Oregon when I was shot. Because any thought that a gang member don't have the intellect to be in college is not, it does not line up with their narrative.
Right,
about,
because they want to solve it. And so to them, it's just like, well, we got him into college. It doesn't line up for us that he's
still
in a gang.
So we're not going to talk about it. But if I tell you that if you really talk to former gang members, they're some of the most intelligent young men you'll ever meet. So you have to start having conversations about why they normalize being in gangs. We don't want to say anymore because there's not fathers in the home, right? We want to talk about white people. But when you look at when black fathers are in the homes, their sons do way better. We can't talk about that data because we keep got to make it about white folks.
Talk about this crisis of black fathers in the home, because there are programs that disincentivize black fathers.
I mean, look at Home Force Section 8. Right. They don't want black fathers in the home. Most of they draw young black women in because it is an opportunity to pay lower rent and lower bills for a while. But then they say, well, he can't be in the home with you. So imagine this. Imagine a young man. Let's say a young man and a young woman have some issues. Right. They're having a kid together. And let's say at that time they want work and they decide they're not going to be together. Well, like most human beings, they grow up a little bit. They decide they want to raise their family together. Section 8 says he cannot be in a home. And the best chance he got is he cannot have a job and he has to ask for some level of special permission. So if he's a low earner, but he works hard for his family, he either has to sneak around that home. So if an inspection happens, we have to pull all of his clothes out of the house. He has to leave the home. The kids have to be coached.
And that's because he's making money, and therefore the whole family doesn't qualify? Well, is that the argument?
I don't think he usually makes enough money. I think they just say he's not on a lease or he can't be on a lease. If he has a job, then he can't be on a lease.
Why?
Listen, if I tell people that that's a systematic problem, then we ignore that.
It just seems like it's so obvious something that needs to be correct. I know it's a federal issue, and well, so
federal government don't have systematic problems.
Oh no, I know, but like, why isn't Kamala Harris talking about something
well,
like this?
I don't think that's the narrative, right? I think that
You're right.
Right,
no, you're right.
It's not the
She's
narrative.
Not allowed to talk about
right,
that.
And yeah. And it ain't that she doesn't know, or people haven't brought it to her. Maybe she's waiting to have tough, you know, make some tough policies to challenge
well,
that.
Well, we've
right?
ceded that talking point to the right wing.
Right. They get to point it out. And the problem with how the white
and then
the
that's
right
racist
wing,
when they
right,
point it out,
but and how they point it out is still, I still challenge the heart of the point out because it's not solution based, right? What I'm saying
how are you going to fix it?
Well, I think people have to go in with power and fix it. I think folks that have to stop talking about, listen, when we get upset enough about it, we will march, picket, and act a fool, and then we get results. Ain't nobody, that doesn't impact regular, everyday people's lives. If I come in here and tell you, hey, Section 8 can be a good thing if done correctly. You have one or two things that you might or may not like. On a more conservative side, you say, oh, there's free stuff. Right. Oh, there's free stuff. And more on a liberal side, you go, oh, don't challenge. Don't, you know, let it is such a beautiful thing.
Right. Let's not touch it. It's a sacred cow. Let's
right, exactly.
It.
But in the middle, is it can be problematic either way if done wrong. In the middle is black fathers that's not allowed to sit in their homes. And let me say something quite frankly. When you got to sneak that black father out of the house and you have to tell the children not to say that they dad lives there, that is traumatic. That is beginning to teach them things about their father that doesn't line up just because they want to survive. We live in one of the most expensive cities in our country. We're often talking about affordability, but we're ignoring the fact that we can't even bring income into homes or in low-income spaces, right? People can never come out of poverty when you do not give them time to come out of poverty. So all these systems that they've set up, right, can be really good things if you allow families to work together. But when you won't allow families to work together and you keeping fathers out of the home that bring income into the home, yeah, folks, black, white, or indifferent, you're going to stay poor. You're going to stay hurting. I'm so over this narrative that black folks got to stay poor. It's not true. We have very wealthy, intelligent, hardworking people in our community. And those are the people that should be championed in these spaces about your ability to go to the next level. Honest dialogue, accessibility, right? But instead, a whole bunch of folks that don't come out of the community are the people we're looking towards to talk about the community. Portland is a unique black community.
Oh, it's a...
Right.
It would have to be.
It has to be.
The whitest big city in America. It would have to be unique.
So why does people who ain't lived here more than a couple years have the biggest voice about black people in this city? I came here when I was 16. I'm 41. This city bred who I am.
Jefferson High School.
Right.
Yeah.
This is my home.
Western Oregon University.
This is my home. But you got somebody that come to this city at 45 years old, decide to be a politic and speak for the whole of this city? You don't understand the culture in this city. We should be lending those voices to people that know this city and understand its issues. When we were talking about police brutality, I'm not talking about what's happening in New York. I want to know the concerns of black people.
Frankly.
Right. I want to know the concerns of black people in this city.
And what's going on with PPB? What do we know about Portland Police Bureau?
That's what I want to talk about.
How does it apply to the black community?
That's what I want to talk about.
That's the only question that should be applied to Portland.
In this city.
I mean, you know what, Terrence? It makes me think of that Measure 110 issue. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize this until they got back from that trip to Portugal that the Drug Policy Alliance tried to fund. And I know the Portland Police Association, the police union, their members paid their way. And I think Jessica Vega Peterson paid her own way, the chair of Multnomah County, and good on them. Other people didn't. But, you know, as Aaron Schmaltz, the head of the PPA, would say, it's expensive. And he gets why they didn't. But I guess the point is, what I learned when they got back was Portugal doesn't have guns or fentanyl. And the minute I heard that, I thought, I don't need to hear anything else. I'm going to stop you right there. We're done here.
Right.
We don't need to do anything here that they did there.
It doesn't apply.
It doesn't apply. And nobody looked into this. I mean, it was astounding to me.
They had a narrative to paint. They pick where they're going to pull that narrative from. They're smart people. They didn't miss
Why would they ship all that? What's weird to me is why they'd ship them all out to Portugal only to learn that nothing can be grafted onto Portland.
Listen, unfortunately,
that worked out for those of us who were behind reforming 110.
Right. And that's the key. Unfortunately, for both sides of the argument, if you love Portugal, you wanted to go prove a point. If you're skeptical, you had to go prove a point. Either way, everybody had to go have that conversation because much like PSR, we seem to pick and choose what we're going to amplify.
Yeah, PSR is Portland Street Response.
Right, and we choose what we're going to amplify without considering that it doesn't apply in a way that we're trying to amplify it. right? And so I believe that's problematic. Like, you know, so we do that. We like to pick. Like, they'll run somewhere and take some model of race relations from some country that never had the issues of race that we've had in this country. And they'll try to bring that model here as if it can apply. It's not the same. It's apples and oranges is all it is. Yeah, they're both fruit, but they come about a little differently.
Talk to us about Portland Street Response. What exactly are you referring to? Because most people hear that and they just think, well, of course we need alternatives to police. What's the issue with Portland Street Response?
Yeah, there is no issue with Portland Street Response. Let's be clear. The issue is when politicians find key words and key things to talk about, knowing it don't apply. Portland Street Response can only be an alternative when it comes to mental health crisis. They were set up to respond that way, but now you have politicians walking around acting like Portland Street Response can start picking up, filling in a gap for criminal behavior. Right? Filling in a gap for every incident, right? We have somebody wielding a knife. Yeah, they might be having a mental episode, but they're still wielding a knife. And then we talk about like fully funding PSR. And I started just asking people, what do you mean when you say that? 90% of the time, they have no answer. They're just repeating, right? They're making value statements and they're hoping voters resonate with that. PSR is an amazing system partner, but they're a system partner. They were created to do a very specific thing. And us trying to make them do something they were not created to do is nonsense, right? They should not be responding to lower level crime. That's nonsense. They are not trained or equipped to deal with crime. They should be working with officers, getting up to places where there's a concern for mental health, really leading a way for that officer to step out of it, right, so that they can deal with the mental health crisis.
Which the officers seem to be happy to do.
Officers are not fighting against PSR. Listen, all these super progressives, as I call them, is the ones creating narratives to put our police against responders like PSR. It's not fair to PSR. It's not fair to our police officers, right? I feel like one of the biggest things you mentioned, Measure 110, is when we create bad narratives. You pit the police against something at the heart could be good, and then this execution is ridiculously bad because it was more about politics than it was about people.
Yeah.
And PSR, if we don't start data and knowledge checking politicians and future candidates, well, these candidates or future council people at the door about PSR, either they're going to get there and forget anyway because they never had intentions or the knowledge it took to impact it, or they're going to create something and create narratives where PSR and officers don't work together because we've created horrific narratives. They work very well in conjunction with each other. I've never heard nobody from PSR say we don't want to have anything to do with our officers and vice versa. Only candidates and politicians say ridiculous things like this.
Terrence, talk to us a little bit about police brutality, because I know that you're involved in community organizations and city organizations that are addressing that directly. Right. And I wonder what you think about that, or if you know about that Roland Fryer evidence. He's a Black Harvard economist. And he, you know, there's that Washington Post database mm-hmm. that keeps track of police killings mm-hmm. of civilians. And he found that even though police nationwide are more likely to use force, so they're harder on Black and Hispanics, mm-hmm. that racial bias didn't translate into the use of deadly force by officers. And I guess my question was, I mean, first of all, I think if you asked somebody in Portland how many Black people have been killed by police, I mean, I think the number would be astronomical. Mm-hmm. I don't think it would line up with mm-hmm. that data. I think the narrative is that, you know, PPB, at least in 2020, I think mm-hmm. it's changed, but I think in 2020 the narrative was PPB was just sort of willy-nilly gunning down Black people. Right. What is going on with this what is going on with this use of force stuff? Mm-hmm. And I've heard various explanations for it, like Glenn Lowry, who's a professor at Brown. Mm-hmm. He has a podcast called The Glenn Show with John McWhorter. They call themselves the Black Guys. His theory is their interface. I mean, he goes back to families and, mm-hmm. and culture and says, look, you know, they're interfacing with people who are committing crimes. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the left wing would say, well, that's a right wing talking point, and that's mm-hmm. racist. And I'm just wondering what your take on this is, because I obviously the police are going to have to deal with this.
Right.
And if they're being harder, if that's true, I mean, if that data, and they seem to, I haven't seen anything refuting it. If that's true, that they're harder, the police are harder on Black people and Hispanic people.
Right.
How do we deal with that?
Yeah. So I say first, it's a culture change, right? We have to, and this is why I said in the beginning, we should have addressed Portland issues
right.
and not like nationwide issues.
Right.
So we can differentiate what Portland is struggling with and what they are not. We
do
need
data. Do we have
data
on Portland specific? Like, do we know if this is true about Portland, that they're harder on, do we keep that data?
I have no idea. But
and
what
we should keep it.
Well, we should. Well, it's going to take some money, right? Somebody has to, right? You know, think about that. Somebody's going to have to put $100,000-$200,000
right.
into collecting that data, and I think we certainly should. Listen, I've
but
talked
Terrence,
to...
But it might disrupt a narrative, so I don't know if we want to do that.
Yeah, but I don't care about the lie of a narrative. I care about the truth that comes from the data, right?
And if that truth
says, look, we have less of an issue with murdering, and remember, I lost a cousin to police violence, okay? But if the data says it's less about murdering and we have a concern or issue with mistreatment, we need that data, because I have several young Black men, including myself, that even before, outside of group and gang or bad behavior, have had bad experiences with police officers,
yeah.
right? For instance, I was a young man leaving a high school party. This was way before the gang stuff and all that. I was just a kid at a party, and I got pulled over in Portland from walking down the streets. I so-called met fit a description, right? The Black narrative.
Sure.
And they, in the middle of the rain, they made us gun drawn on us. Three high school kids, no indicator of us having a gun. They made us come out of our boots in Portland rain and stand there. Why did I need to come out of my shoes in order to be checked? And that's some racist concerns. We look and we say, there's no reason for me to come out of my shoes. That is nonsense. Whoever made that call should not have a job, right? But if those are the issues, we need to deal with those issues, right? We need to stop building out of something. So what does that mean? We need to be at the table. Black folks need to be at the table expressing those concerns. And that way, when we're at the table, when police are engaging young Black men, they can have a conscience of awareness. Hey, I need to be aware. I always say, people, the worst thing we can do is not explain to officers that that young man is not nervous because they're guilty of something. They nervous because they've been taught that you are looking for a reason to shoot them. That's a narrative issue, right? So I'm really glad that I've worked with the FIT team, the Focus Intervention team, and that we see the byproduct of community engagement, which is we're saying, hey, say this when they look nervous, behave like this, bring them down, de-escalate, tell them it's okay. It's okay, Mr. Policeman, to tell the nervous young Black kid or Hispanic kid or white kid that they're going to be okay. Man, give me your license and insurance. Relax, man. You good. You okay. Are you feeling safe? And my son got pulled over. My teenage son got pulled over, and he said the officer kept asking him, are you okay? Are you okay? But guess why we have conscious officers.
So it's working.
Right. But we do that because Black folks are now at the table having real dialogue with officers.
And so what was the channel through which you were able to communicate that? Was that the FitCog team channel?
That was the FitCog, right? But I chair that cog, right? So when black folks are at the table with a little bit of authority, we can have honest dialogue. And officers, most officers, I don't believe have a murderous spirit about themselves. I don't think they wake up thinking, how do we get the black kid, right? And those are the officers I'm talking to. If that officer is murderous, there's nothing I can say to him,
no,
he or
that's
she,
true.
Right? We got to find that behavior. We got to try to get into it earlier and weed it out. But our other officers, I'm saying, you've been taught something through life. Life teaches us all things about each other. Let me assure you that most, definitely most of our young black men are not toting guns. They're not committing crimes. There is a few of them that are. We're creating things like ceasefire to be able to isolate that data, find those individuals, hold them accountable.
Talk about ceasefire for people who don't know what that program is.
I love ceasefire. Ceasefire is the gun violence reduction model that the city of Portland has chosen to implement. It's ran by Sierra Ellis, who is their director. And this model is, it used data, right, to determine the most dangerous people when it comes to gun violence in our community. So one of the ways it does that is every week PPB does a shooting review. So we look at all, not we, because I ain't in it, I ain't quite approved for that, but they look at all the shootings from the week before, they take all the police reports, they compile that data, they look at people that's involved. What I love about ceasefire is it does two unique things. First, where accountability is going to happen or enforcement, it helps officers make plan for those engagements. So instead of being willy-nilly, we're talking about family. We're even reaching out to family members in some cases and say, look, that young man was involved in a shooting. Let's work this thing out to where the police ain't kicking the door in, right? We want to talk about it. So I love that community relationship is there. But secondly, and the thing I love the most, is that shooting review allows referrals to come out to ceasefire. Those referrals, when it comes to ceasefire assigns them the community-based organization for resources, right? This is resources, because those individuals are not up for enforcement, and a lot of time they are not the shooters. They are just involved, right? They might have been in a house. They might be at risk of being retaliatory shooters, and we get resources to them. We get them on the right path. We help their families. In some cases, we relocate people. So while people think that we're not doing some things and making some amazing changes, we are, and this is why you see, along with our officers and community-based organizations that's doing the work, even the ones that's not under this model, this is why we see a 30% reduction in gun violence in the community, because we're actually working together. And I'll stand on this. There is probably 10 people, and I would talk about in our community, the black community, there's about 10 legit violent shooters.
That's it. And everybody's identified who these individuals are.
Yes. And the goal, if they're not up for enforcement, to offer them resources and opportunity to get on another path. But if not, let's be really clear, if not, then we do focused enforcement where our officers are going to go after those shooters in one way or another. And in fact, when you have dangerous shooters in the community that refuse to take a path to another way, accountability is all we have.
Yeah, and by accountability, I mean
you need prison. To go to jail. Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. You need to go to jail. And the fact of the matter is, people come in and say, no. Well, you tell the mom that had to bury her baby that she don't deserve accountability.
Right, right.
And I'm going to tell you she's going to disagree, because guess what? She not just deserve justice for that loss, but she's worried about her son retaliating, her nephew retaliating, or her nephew being your next victim. So it's not just about her pain. It's about not wanting to experience another pain. And let me be clear.
And there'll be other families. Yeah. I mean, if these people are running around, there'll be other victims.
I promise you. There's only a few people. There is not a million young black kids walking around here shooting. There's a few. And we're doing what we can to isolate that in those individuals based on the data and then hold them accountable. And I'll stand on that as both a victim of gun violence and a perpetrator of it. Accountability.
You were almost killed.
Yeah, I was. Accountability is not contrary to restorative justice. And I wish people will stop pushing restorative justice as if it does not consider the victim or the family of the person that's been harmed.
Well, and you and I talked about this on the last episode. I mean, I think restorative justice has kind of lost a fair amount of meaning.
Facts.
Do you have an idea of what restorative justice actually means or what an effective sense of restorative justice would be?
Right. I want to say it from my perspective because any definition I give, you're going to have 100 PhDs arguing with me about it, okay? I would say from my position as a person that feel like my life was impacted by restorative justice, I was held accountable for the crime I committed. I was able to come home, right? And you can say what you want to say. What I do love about what Mike Schmidt did is he brought a conscious awareness to restorative justice. Now, there are some other things we have some concerns about for sure, but there is, you know, we had a DA at that time that was willing to have the conversation. I worked my butt off. I served in my community, and now I don't have a criminal record.
Yeah, I think you're an example of where that works.
That's where, for me, that's where restorative justice is. Now, there will be cases, especially I think with minor, lower-level crimes, where the victims will prefer, right, clean up your graffiti, right, if you've done it. If you've stolen from me, replace it. But I think this narrative that restorative justice gets shoved down the throat of victims is problematic. I was really grateful that family showed up from the person I had hurt, showed up and was willing to say, we want to see Terrence move forward. We see the work he's doing in community. We see his commitment to change. We see his family, and we believe that he should be restored back to his community.
The victim was involved, and the victims agreed.
Period.
That's very different.
Because I wouldn't be given, they cannot be restored if they don't have a voice.
That's right. No, that's right. And that was the criticism
about
a lot of those commutations and about a lot of the people that were released is that the victims weren't notified. Right. And some of those, I mean, a lot of those crimes were not your crime, which if people recall from your episode, you had almost been murdered.
Yeah.
And that's the context that you were operating.
Right, for sure. For sure.
And some of these other crimes were, I mean, these were people who were systematically targeted by just murders. Like no gang context.
No, just horrific murderers, rapists, pedophiles. That's I don't know if we could say that on radio these days, but I'm gonna say it.
That's right.
My mom, I grew up with a mom who often was honest about being molested as a child, right? And that taught me how to value and protect my sister, my wife, my daughters, right? To this day, my mom's life has been impacted by that individual's decision and the fact that that individual were never held accountable. Me and my mom never received justice. And if you ask her today if she wants to sit in a room with a man who molested her, who never apologized, when she went to her family called her a liar and mistreated her. If you ask her today, she would say no. She wants him to go to jail and quite frankly probably want him to die because she's pretty sure he's continued to harm children along the way. There gotta be some reason in policy, and we've lost that. We've lost the reasoning.
Well, yeah, and just some moderation,
some damn
common sense.
Right,
I mean, it's not rocket science. It really is just common sense, and I think the majority of Portlanders agree with you.
We see the direction. Portland is now saying, we want accountability, and it's never stopped saying we believe in restorative justice.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I don't think that, I think the DA's race and Nathan Vasquez's win shows they want accountability, but I don't hear Nathan saying he wants to, I don't hear him saying he wants to eliminate restorative justice. No. I don't think that he does.
He doesn't. So I had a conversation with Nathan. It's interesting that all the restorative justice people is so against me all of a sudden, even though I've been doing this work for so long.
And even though you're a product of the restorative justice, of the restorative justice policies.
I'm not a product of a narrative. The minute I accepted Renee Gonzalez's endorsement, I had a whole community oppose me, not because of my value system, but the how they perceived his. Right. If you knew how many people that I've worked with in restorative justice called me or commented or opposed me, I've even had people oppose fundraisers for me because of Renee Gonzalez's endorsement of me. Right. I've endured some of the most ridiculous things because of that association. Right. And then far be it for me. I mean, they think that's mad. Vasquez has endorsed me. Right. So if they think that's offensive.
And this is after you endorse his opponent, right. Mike Schmidt.
I helped Mike fundraise. Right. You got to understand.
Yeah.
I've been a part of that process. But when I talk to Nathan.
Nathan's above politics.
He cares about people.
Yes,
and,
he does.
And
what he
loved about him is he said, Terrence, they have no reason to say the things they say. And I thought, dang, they're saying the same thing about me now, right? So that's interesting. And one of the things I talked to Nathan about is I said, look, Mike Schmidt stood up the Justice Integrity Unit. That was very important for people like me who had done the right things and needed an opportunity. And I said, are you going to get rid of it? And he said, no. Terrence, I've never said that. Now, of course, there are some concerns and some things I want to see happen to make sure the right people is getting that opportunity and not people who haven't changed and will cause more harm. But Terrence, I've never said that I don't believe in restorative justice. I'm going to stand with people who do the right thing. Me saying I stand with victims does not mean that I don't want to see pathways for people who've made mistakes. I said, Nathan, historically, the DA's office has counted its success through the man hours or prison days, right? That's how you know you're a good district attorney. What is going to be your matrix? So I'm really concerned about whether or not we're going to get back to that old way of being a DA. And he said, Terrence, I'll measure my success based on, we're talking about gun violence, let's be contextual. He said, I'll measure my success based on gun violence reduction, whether that's through helping to stand up programs and defending programs in the community, or whether that's through accountability, right? My matrix is, does gun violence reduce? That's what it's about. It's not about man hours and man days. And I was really impressed with that response. Now, am I going to be watching Nathan the whole way? Am I going to be on his tail? And am I going to be expecting him to stand and do the things he said? Certainly. He doesn't get a pass from that. The black community is disproportionately impacted by the decisions that he'll make in that office. And because I love that community with all of my heart, Nathan doesn't get a pass. Gonzalez doesn't get a pass. We don't agree on everything. I like the type of leader he is. I believe that everything he say he is, and he's not going to become a different version of himself. So certainly I endorse Renee Gonzalez for mayor. Because I know what type of leader we're going to get. And everybody else I'm looking at, I'm not quite sure yet what type of leader that they're going to be.
One of the things that I'm curious about is we've got this, and I think it's important, you know, we have the FitCog team, mm-hmm. and we just talked about how, you know, you said that the amount of people that are under scrutiny for committing, engaging in gun violence. Mm-hmm. You're saying y'all know who they are.
For sure.
And people are, we've got data on this.
Right.
And it's a relatively small number.
Right.
So this is from the Oregonian, and it was in 2023. So February 2023, a little over a year ago. And What they said is that, yes, more than half of Portland's homicide victims in 2022 were mostly black men. Mm-hmm. And that's where that, you know, far more dangerous to be a black man in Portland than
right.
peer cities, which is just astounding to
right.
me. But, you know, apparently that small group of people are committing a fair amount of havoc.
Right.
And that's why it sounds like, you know, people are really focused on that. But right. but it also, this article also says more than, and I'll link to it in the show notes, more than, or about a third of these homicides, these killings in 2022 involved homeless people.
Right.
Both as victims and yeah, as perpetrators. Sure. I mean, Terrence, what I'm wondering is, where is the FitCog team on the drug? Let's just, I'm going to stop calling it homeless right. because I think we're talking about, I think the data shows
right.
that in terms of people sleeping on the sidewalk, we're not talking about somebody a paycheck away from a rent payment.
Right, facts.
You know, we're talking about mental illness
right.
and drug addiction.
Right.
And you've struggled with drug addiction in your family, your right. parents, right. your sister. I've got it with my sister. I've got severe mental illness or had severe mental illness with my late father.
Right.
Died in a veteran's home, just brought in off the streets. Mm. So, you know, what I'm wondering is here in Portland, where is the focus
right.
on these homicides of street people? And it just seems right. to me that it's not progressive
right.
to allow people to die on the sidewalks.
Right, for sure. So just for clarity, the FIT team is one thing. The FIT COG is different. The FIT COG is the
Thank
community
you.
Oversight group. That's the COG part. The FIT team is the focus intervention team, right? Our job as the COG is to watch the team, right? That's our job.
But FIT COG isn't it specifically geared? Is it specifically geared towards, for lack of a better word, gang violence?
Right.
Or,
no.
Or are the... You know, our street
right.
homeless people like drug addicts and mentally ill people, are they included?
They are. So I'll tell you this.
And I didn't know that.
One of the biggest things that members at a FitCog like Lionel Irvin, who runs Love is Strong, great
yeah,
dude.
He's been on this podcast. I mean, he's great.
Amazing dude. One of his biggest concerns is that as a city, we are not giving our houseless community the attention it needs as far as gun violence reduction.
That's exactly right.
But he knows this for a few reasons. One, we got to stop acting like the FIT team was not put together in wake of increased gun violence from the black and brown community, right? Even though they do deal with all gun violence, they were put together during a very specific period of time. And so I believe that the way...
2020.
We had the record numbers in gun violence in the black and brown
that's,
communities.
That's right.
So there was a response to that. Now, the overall goal and objective is all gun violence, but we would be lying if we didn't say that they were stood up during a very specific time and that their gifts and talents could definitely lean there more than inside of houses caps. Now, one of the things I will say is that we both know if police go storming camps, it's gonna be a shit show, right?
It's too dangerous.
It's not a good look. What we need to do is we need to bring people in and we need to look at the data and decide the best methods to reduce gun violence. We did a problem analysis for that period of time. This is why we have ceasefire. They did a problem analysis and they were able to figure out 7 key things that reflected gun violence in Portland. And this is how we built out the FIT team and stuff like that.
Group
and gang, I'll say them all if I can remember it. Group and gang involvement. Ages from, I think it was like 16 to 32 or something like that, was a big driver in gun violence. Were you on parole and probation, which is like a crazy thing that's a determiner because you're on parole and probation. You should be a little less prone to commit crimes, but not true, clearly. Have you been a victim or a victimizer of gun violence historically before? It's a few more. I can't remember them all, but they determined through this problem analysis some key factors that lead to gun violence or retaliation or victimization in our city. What I've said is we should be doing a problem analysis also for homeless camp violence and what's coming out of it. That way, we are data driven. We don't listen. We do not want to put officers in a situation where they're running into communities of people making, you know, willy-nilly determinations. We know that didn't work. One of the biggest problems we had with GVRT is not that they were not effective, but
GVRT is
gang violence reduction team. Right. So what they did that was really problematic is they threw out these wide nets.
And that was eliminated.
Right. That was eliminated. Right.
And its place is
FIT. Right, which is more data-driven. The FIT team is only supposed to use data-driven investigative tools, right? They look at the data, and they're going after shooters. They are not, we do not allow them to do the random things, right? They are not supposed to behave like regular patrol officers, right? They are supposed to be very intentional about who they engage. It's supposed to be people that have been identified as high risk for gun violence. That's it. Right now, they're still officers, right? I'm not going to say that they're going to watch you speed down the street at 100 miles an hour and ain't going to respond. Certainly they are, right? But I would just say, were you in an area where there's gun violence? They even see that car moving that fast. But yeah, that's the thing. There's not a lot of shooters. Like, listen, people in our community know. Like, and if we don't stop painting a picture that there's a lot of young men committing, especially young black men committing violent crimes, we'll continue to have this thing where young black men are at high risk, right? Where we're worried about police violence against the community. If we stay data-driven, our officers won't even be in a situation to commit those type of harms, right? We have to use the data to reduce gun violence. And if we do that right, then our officers can target the highest, most dangerous people in the community.
What kinds of things are you going to do on city council? Like, what will be your priority? Let's just say number one.
Number one, you get elected.
What's your number one priority?
Public safety. We gotta deal with the narrative that don't allow us to hire more officers. People do not want to be police officers, and I don't have a perfect answer to how we convince folks that serving on a police force is good for community. But we gotta have leadership that's willing to step up. Call out wrong if officers do wrong, but certainly say thank you for the officers that do the good work every day, right? And if we can help change that narrative and get people back into it, I think we can even get everyday community people to buy back into policing, and folks can actually police in their communities. We'll do good. We allow our elected officials to turn their back instead of changing things that needed to be changed. They turned their back. They allowed the narrative to go out, get out of control. So we gotta restore our police force to at least the numbers that they've been financially granted, right? It was still 100 officers short at that number and a couple hundred officers short at best practice. So we have to figure out how to clean that narrative up. In public safety, I believe we need to increase at least damn near by 100% our investment in the Office of Violence Prevention. We have to get resources to community-based organizations that do the work. When we see our officers and community work together, we see reduction in violence and crime in our community. We have to holistically invest. No extremities either way. Anybody that's screaming we don't need police, they just talking. They don't know what they're talking about. So y'all need to start heat checking bad candidates that say silly stuff like that. And anybody that say we only need police don't know what they talking about. And they probably live in more privilege than not. It's just nonsense. We need both. And we need to bridge the gap of both to get the best results. So as your city council representative, I am going to increase our investment in public safety. I'm going to fight to help rebuild the narrative of our officers. And I'm going to make sure community has community leaders that's invested in to continue to do the work. That is my number one priority.
Do you have an understanding of what's going on? My understanding is there's going to be two new ballot measures that the police, Portland Police Association, the mm-hmm. police union are working on mm-hmm. because their last couple of ballot measures were not seemed to be unsuccessful mm-hmm. within Multnomah County Circuit Court, and they were challenged by the Oregon ACLU.
Right.
Do you have an understanding of? I mean, I think a lot of people voted in that police accountability right. ballot measure because they saw the words police accountability.
Right. Yeah, I was.
I don't think they knew what they were voting for. I think it's a lot like 110.
No, I think. I'll agree with you, and I think it was a lot like 110. I think the hard is what people liked. I think the execution is problematic, right? So when you look at that, I was one of the few people that came and said this notion that this committee can go to this extreme on police accountability and think it's going to be successful is nonsense and actually problematic, right?
You were at City Council.
I was at City Council. So when I looked at that, I said, was this the heart and the intent of voters? It didn't seem to be that way. We did what we always do. We pick words. We rile our voters up, and then we execute contrary to I think, the heart of their wishes, right? Because we choose such extremity, now we are at risk of police putting a lot of resources into combating this. One of the things that me and Aaron Smeltz talk a lot about is like...
Aaron is the head of the Portland Police Association. The union,
One of the things we often talk about and wrestle about is like, I believe he believes in police accountability too, but he's speaking from an officer's view. Let's be clear.
Well, he's also speaking from a union head view.
Right, so for sure.
The question that he's really looking at is, did the officer follow procedure?
Right, and that's
really not a moral question.
It's not a moral, which is two different things as we know. So yeah. I believe we need that oversight group for community. What I don't believe is we need a narrative where the key to that is to just bring in people that's looking for mistakes, not looking for solutions, and not willing to look at the law, right? Everybody deserves due process. If we're not careful, the way they originally set up that, it felt more about simply how you felt and less about the laws and practices and procedures. I like the compromises that the city council made. I thought there were some fair ones. I don't agree with everyone, right? I'll give you an example. We went from no police family till you can go up to a first cousin. And I'm like, I was raised like a brother with my first cousins, right? If we're going to make that the issue, come on, your first cousin, your mama, sister, son. Like, if we're talking about biases, let's stop being ridiculous, right? If we're going to either your family is allowed or they not, right? So, yeah, there's different sides.
They didn't want people on the commission who had any family member whatsoever with some kind of tie to law enforcement.
Right, but we were fine with people like myself who've been harmed by losing a family member.
Yeah, then we needed to be people who identified as being over-policed.
Right, but can I say something?
Yeah,
even though a lot of black people have been over-policed, it doesn't mean they don't have the rational ability to make good decisions about harm. Every black person is not looking to throw police away. But if I pick people who have been so harmed because I've experienced that level of harm that we can only look through a lens of the harm, that's problematic. But there are people in the black community that grew up with police that gave out the McGruff stickers and, you know what I mean, that had healthy relationships. But they also have had some tough times. Right, you know what I mean, and the badges. But they've also had tough times, and they can bring balance to those conversations. We need balance people. We do not need any extremities, because all that's going to happen is the moment you make an extreme decision, you get a bunch of litigation. You rebuild distrust in black and brown communities with policing, and we're right back where we're standing. Then
we decimate the police force even further.
Here we go.
If we think they're going to stick around for that.
They're not. Right? And I don't want
to be involved in hiring and firing, discipline.
I always say, you know me, I said this at the council meeting.
Where was the
black folks in these conversations?
I know. And if I remember correctly, so I went to some of those meetings and if some of the Police Accountability Commission meetings, and if I remember correctly, I don't think that the majority of the commissioners were black.
There's only a few of them.
Yeah,
it's only a few. But that's what I'm telling you in the beginning. Who's controlling these narratives and who's pushing them? Because
I mean, I think it was Commissioner Joanne Hardesty who was black, and so yeah. I think that's where we took our. I say we.
People.
The majority of Portlanders who are white,
right.
You know, we're taking the direction from and just assuming, well, that this must be representative.
Yeah. I mean, she did really well in convincing all of Portland that she speak for all black people in Portland. She did really good at that. I mean, I find that interesting because Portland has had some amazing leaders that actually have been in this city so long.
Yes.
They understand the ins and out. But, you know, like
Talk
I said.
About who they, I mean, obviously, look. I'm just going to go out. I'm just going to say it because I don't want you to feel bashful.
Right.
But you're one of them.
Right. It's been folks. I mean,
I think Lionel Irving's one of them.
Listen, you got Lionel Irving. You got people like Michael Fesser. You got leaders in this community that's been doing this work a long time.
Overlooked.
Well, yeah, because they're doing the work. See, the difference, I always want to say
this. They're not the politicians.
Right. The difference between an activist and somebody that's actively doing the work is night and day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Activists talk about the work that the active person do. Those are two different things, right? The reason I didn't come in with the same level of support, say, like as a Candace Avalos, is because she's an activist. I do the work. She's an activist for her specific space. I've done the work in my specific space. I've impacted the lives of black men in my specific space.
For a lot of time, to be fair, for a lot of the time, you were in prison.
Absolutely. My body of work now is only...
You were doing other things.
Right. My body of work now is only because I was legit in prison, too. Instead of telling young black men to hurt each other, I was talking about their intelligence and their ability to impact the community. I'm surrounded by folks who believe in me because of the body of work. People, like, and I'll keep pointing her out. She keeps championing herself as a voice of a community that she don't have ties to.
Are you talking about Candace?
You're damn right. And I'm talking about anybody else in these activist spaces that continue to act like they can speak for a community they ain't done no work in outside of political. Listen, if you chose to stand up doing the riots and all that, I mean, doing the marches and riots and all that, and that's your starting place for standing with the black community, you suspect to me. Because it's been a lot of amazing black men and women that were standing with the community way before it became popular in this city.
And after.
And continue to, because a lot of them ain't doing, you know, a lot of the activists then got comfortable again.
Well, they seem to have disappeared.
Listen, if you don't know that OVP's budget has almost diminished to its former self when ARPA funds are running.
OVP?
Office of Violence Prevention. This is who funds at the higher levels with the city. A lot of our not-for-profits that specialize in gun violence reduction. That we, because of ARPA funding and other funding, we had about a $12, $14 million budget. Now we're down to $4 million, and $3 million of that.
Who's responsible for that?
Well, listen, it's the city council, right? They've only wrote about $750,000 in the general fund.
They reduced your budget?
Well, no, they just didn't match it. So though that increase came from ARPA funding. Right. And when that funding, that's federal funding.
Okay.
I can't remember the acronym, but it's federal funding during that emergency.
And so we lost that. Is that what happened?
Yeah, we used it and we didn't match it. But this is what I'm talking about. Activism.
I understand.
Right. When we're about to lose the ability to sustain the community based organizations that do the work, where are these activists? Where are they? They not paying attention to those organizations because they're not talking to them. They're not building with them. They don't do the work with them. They don't know them. If I get so irritated at these forums when these candidates is talking about ceasefire and have no idea what they're talking about. Like every time I'm at one, it's like we need to invest in things like ceasefire that focus on focus on resources and enforcement. But they won't say that because they don't meet the narrative of how they think public safety look. Right. And then they name drop a program that I've been essential in help develop and bridge the gap in community. Then it's just nonsense to me because they actually have no idea. The same thing with Portland Street Response. We spent the same thing with ceasefire. All these activists ain't done no work. They got big old salaries. The first 6 or 7 years after I came home, I spent time showing up to all these places where they wanted to hear my voice, and they didn't want to pay me a dime to be there. Everybody was making over $100,000 a year. But the men and women that stories was being told made nothing. This is that not-for-profit.
I did not know that.
Of course.
No. It's not public because there's no transparency. So we don't know. We can't do a Freedom of Information Act request on any of these nonprofits that are essentially really public entities.
I said this and I challenge anybody. Show me one of these candidates that actually is running their mouth about public safety that have any lived experience, one to be impacted by police or to even help them. Everybody's just talking. Everybody is leveraging the black story to push a narrative that's comfortable for them, but they're not showing up in black spaces. I'm tired of it. And until they actually are engaging with people that do the work, that's formerly incarcerated or been harmed or harmed in gun violence, until they show up in those spaces, they need to stop acting like they know what they're talking about. Period, point blank. Most of them just never ran a business, never developed a small business into a successful business, but they keep talking about what it takes to sustain businesses. They've never done the work. Most of them is talking about a clean Portland, and they outside of when they can put on a vest and feel good about themselves with their other friends, they've never been a part of cleaning up our city.
And that's literally your business. You clean up graffiti.
That's literally what I do. And in fact, I'm so community focused. I hire formerly incarcerated black men and women out of the community to do that work, pay them a living wage, and love when I can win a prevailing wage job so that they can make almost $50 an hour. See, there's a difference between being an activist and being active. That's why I dismiss them. Is they don't know what they're talking about. When we was at a forum and I talked about hiring formerly incarcerated people and hiring people of high risk of gun violence, and the minute we did that, Tamir and other folks start talking about they just start talking about everything but giving these kids good jobs to take care of themselves. And Loretta, thank God for Loretta Smith, because she was like, did y'all hear anything Terrence said? He's actually hiring formerly incarcerated people, yeah. And he have 100% recidivism. I mean, you know, not recidivism rate. So
they're not going back.
They're not reoffending. They're employed. So when you start talking, I made the comment, when you're talking about tree canopies and all that in East Portland, it don't resonate.
Right.
Because we don't know we need it. It's because it's not our number one priority. Everybody that's leading the way in fundraising in East Portland actually seem to be totally detached on what's important to East Portland. And it's getting old. If you don't think public safety and tents and houselessness is a priority for East Portland, you should not represent East Portland. If you have the gumption to sign anything that will say that you won't ultimately take or deal with our police, you should not be representing East Portland. I think there are some amazing people that signed it, but those are the same people that's damn near committed themselves to drawing boundaries between them and law enforcement. How, if we know we have a public safety issue, are you doing anything that might cause a wedge between you and the police force? But they did it because they basically have to, because that's what good old politicians do, or politics do. It force you to align even when you know it's nonsense.
Yeah, and it makes me wonder if they're reading the polls, because the polls say that people want police.
Yeah.
So it's confusing to me. It doesn't seem to resonate with most Portlanders.
Yeah, they know. But again, they double down on bad policy. I mean, we just seen in Rose City Reform, Candace Avalos was insistent that East Portland, that basically only reason Vasquez and Gonzalez won out there, Commissioner Gonzalez won out there, was because there was not enough voter turnout. She can accept the notion that East Portland knows what it wants, and then she says she's the best candidate for East Portland. You ain't paying attention to East Portland. Any candidate, and I think still some amazing candidates, right? But any candidate that would sign that under any form of your own views or nonsense should not represent East Portland. I'll continue to say that. As amazing as some people are, East Portland want more officers. Why would I do anything to go against that? Are you representing your own political views, or are you truly representing the political views of East Portland?
Well, and that's why I think you're interesting, because you have not only lived experience, but you're serving your community on these organizations, and you are working necessarily. You have to work
right
with the police on have the to. As part of FitCog.
Have to,
and you've got dialogue with everybody from the police union president to chief. I'm assuming Chief Day
for sure. He answers my calls.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise right. me. To other candidates running for city council, mm-hmm. like Eli Arnold, who's on. Portland Police yep. Bureau Bike Squad.
Yeah, I love Eli. Eli is interesting because, again, people think they know him, but he's also, me and him is planning a time where he's going to go and listen to the concerns of the people doing the work every day. I presented this to Eli. He jumped on it. He didn't even think twice of Terrence, when yeah. and where, and I'll be there.
Yeah.
Right? But if I presented this to some of these other candidates, then they would look at me like I was a lunatic. Oh, okay. But they don't follow up. Eli has followed up with me. I'm setting it up to where I'm going to give a voice to people that actually work in gun violence, and I'm going to invite candidates out to have real conversations. And I'm interested to see if that's going to change their stance on certain things. I don't think it will. I think people marry bad policy.
So do you have any understanding of what happened with the Police Accountability Commission rule that they don't have to go on a police ride-along because it would cause... I think their argument was it would cause some yeah. kind of trauma for them to yeah. be around police officers. And then, of course, my understanding was, as part of that Police Accountability Commission ballot measure, they also all get their own private security detail. And
you gotta be joking.
No, you didn't know this? It's true.
They get
their own private security detail. And they also get mental health counseling.
Oh Lord. Okay. I'm gonna give them mental health counseling. I'll give them that. I'm not gonna fight that. But listen, if you won't go on a police ride along, you're not gonna go inside of those communities that police are in.
Well, yeah, it seems right? like a conundrum.
They're not going to go. Listen, how are you going to even understand if they're doing their work correctly those cars?
Yeah, that was the question.
This is what I'm saying. This is pure nonsense. It is pure. How do you understand if black and brown people are being mistreated if you're not willing to put yourself at risk to stand? The difference between an activist and somebody that's active is the work. That's what will always separate the two. I've never in my life, I've been behind police cars for all the negative reasons. And the minute I had a chance to do a ride along, I took it. Because as much as I wanted to understand the work of those officers, I wanted to see and make sure that people are being treated kindly and with respect. And I'm going to say something else. Is I'm the type of person, when I see police pull people over or that you see the engagement, I stop and wait because I actually care. I don't anticipate or expect bad stuff. I actually care. And because I have a voice in this space, if I see the bad behavior, I'm going to leverage my voice to hold them accountable. But I also want to make sure that if I see community members acting a fool, I can go back into community and say, hey, that wasn't productive. That don't help us. I'm gonna fight what's right no matter what. I'm at a point with this. District 1 in this city needs honest people to help get our city back on track. People has pushed a policy that has taken us down. They've championed it. They've doubled down on it. And in fact, it scares me that those are the same people that's in this race, especially in District 1.
Terrence, talk to us about fundraising. Where are you on that? If people want to donate to you, where do they go?
Yeah, so teamhazeforportland.com. I will say that again. Team
and I'll link to it.
Please link to it. So, yeah, we're doing, you know, I'm feeling really grateful because, again, people, one of the comments for Candace Avalos is like, oh, the best fundraisers in District 1 are all super progressive and we don't want officers, more police. And it's interesting that, like, somehow super fundraising means that you got the best interest. It feels elitist, right? But anyway, I'm doing good. I mean, I know I have to shoot the shot, but I'm doing really good. We're well over the 300, ticking on the door of 400. We want to go for that 750. We get that the next level donor match at 750. And you're going to need it. Listen, you still need mailers that are very expensive. You need signs.
Yeah, 'cause people are going to wonder where is the money going and why is it so darn expensive?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, shoot, maybe the cost of papers. I don't know.
But those mailers are expensive.
They are.
And the data is that it's effective. And then the signs.
Super expensive.
The data is that the signs are effective and you got to print those things.
Yeah, I'm really grateful because all of my staff now is volunteer, right? We haven't had to pay anybody.
That is impressive.
Yeah, we do. I mean, and once we get the money, I think people are worth their work, right? We're going to definitely, but right now, I just got people who believe in what I'm trying to do. We ain't paying out no big salaries. We really just want to get the voters aware, right? If one day I can afford to pay folks who've loved and cared for me, I definitely am. But right now, we want to put that money into having dialogue with the voters and getting them a sense of who I am and what I'm doing. So all the contributions help, right? Like for folks to be able to donate.
As little as $5.
As little as $5.
You get a 9x city matching.
Ain't that nice?
Buy Terrence a cup of coffee and donate $5.
That's it. It's easy.
It turns into $45.
Yeah. And if you donate 20, it turns into 200. Like, this is crazy.
Right. And I want to be clear. You can donate. So the top is what?
350.
And you can donate the 350 and it'll turn into 200.
Right. You still get the 200 and the 350. That feels pretty good.
Yeah.
You know?
Your money goes a long way.
No, it does. It does. And what I'm really excited about is like, look, the good thing about this program is it does add a kind of another level of accountability when it comes to campaign financing. It's a lot of checks and balances with this. I gotta give them that. We've done well. I don't spend campaign money on anything that doesn't even perfectly define campaign. Not a cup of coffee, not a dinner. I literally could have a big dinner that's talking about my campaign and all that. I don't put
Look, I mean, you've got to follow the ethical rules and
every
stuff.
Every time.
But I think, look, if people care about this city, I don't care what district you live in. If this is persuasive to you, if you're listening to this and you think you like what Terrence Hayes has to say, I don't care what district you're in.
Don't matter.
Your people in your district, they're going to have to work with people in every other district. And if you want a normal, rational city council that is implementing policies that reflect your values, that reflect Portland's values, donate to Terrence Hayes because you don't need to be in his district to get the matching.
You need
to be in the city of Portland.
Yep.
So if you're within the city of Portland and what Terrence Hayes is saying resonates with you, I recommend that you donate whatever you can to him so that we can bring some common sense to this enormous city council. It's 12 people.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a ton, but if you look at what we've got now, I mean, we've got Rubio, Maps, Ryan, obviously Wheeler's the mayor, and Gonzalez, and that's it. That's our current city council. We're going to have 12 city councilors and a mayor.
Yeah.
So these people have to be able to work together, and if you want them to represent the majority of Portlanders' values, even if you can't vote for them, the money does help, does it not, Terrence? I mean, it's not like it doesn't help.
For sure. It allows us to get the word out. Yeah, it allows us to get the word out. And that's all we're using the money for. We want to get the word out. We want to make sure that community understands that there are rational people that want to help get our city back on track.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful that, you know, there are a lot of loud voices – nationally, there are a lot of loud voices at the fringes, of the right and the left. Mm-hmm. And in Portland, our problem doesn't seem to be the fringe right. Now, outside of Portland, yeah, you know, Oregon's right. got a fair amount of issues with the fringe right. Within Portland, the loudest people in the room, and Terrence, you know this, we've been at city council meetings together, that's the fringe left. That's the white lady calling Mingus Maps a race traitor or calling you a race traitor.
Right.
And in order to let people know that that does not reflect the majority of Portlanders' values, you know, I think what's really important is being active and speaking out. But you can look, if you're not willing to do that, you can do it with your checkbook.
Yes.
You can make a, you can make a donation to any of these candidates within any district who reflect your values, like Terrence Hayes in District 1.
Yep. And we appreciate it.
Terrence, anything else that that you want to talk about today?
No, I'm grateful. I think our city is really excited about change. I think we have a lot of work ahead of us, and I hope that our city choose people that's ready to do the work and that's willing to come to the table and work together.
Thanks for coming on again.
Absolutely.
Friend
Thank
of
you.
The show.
Friend of the show.
Terrence Hayes running for City Council District 1.
Thank you.